Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, this is Ralph Pointer. What's happening Tuesday, September the 4th, 2018? And we're going to turn the mic over to Ayanna Esseline.
Good evening, it's Ayanna Esseline.
And Ralph Pointer. And we are going to speak about the problems of America, which in turn are the problems of the world. But first, what I believe. The overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our laborers for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, move lynching indoors. The police, as the army of occupation, have taken lynching outside again. The lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. And because the lives of our heroes or sheroes who once protected us in our communities do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up. Now is the time. The issue that we are going to discuss two things that are terms of our viewpoint of what's the problem in America. And I tried to think, and I says, well, what is the most important thing that we people of color are facing? And in an analysis of what brings a community down is a community that has no education or training or skills. It's all considered education of one sort or another. And no jobs to sustain oneself. Take those two things and you can destroy any community, any place. And that is the tool of imperial powers to destroy the various communities that they oppose. But I came to the conclusion that the overriding element, third element, that will destroy anything, and hypocrisy, America is thy name. And what brought me to that was listening to the hearings for a Supreme Court justice. And it will make you sick if you understand the reality of what's going on. How do we get into this situation of this one Supreme Court justice, the nomination, as important? Well, I have to go back to the hypocrisy of the left, the right, the middle, and black Americans, ourselves, because it would not have happened if we didn't have Clarence Thomas, the sure right wing, the vote to be counted upon by the regressive elements in America, Clarence Thomas. So the question is, how did we get Clarence Thomas? Who supported this man? He's a male figure, not a man. Well, the money came from apartheid South Africa, apartheid Israel, right-wing Christians, all supported by black religious leaders, black Negro preachers, and the hypocrisy of black folk in general, the hypocrisy of the black misleadership class, as Glenn Ford so well states, and the hypocrisy of the left, allowed the regressive, fascist thinking, white people, white organizations, white institutions, white government to play the race card against us. We did not attack Clarence Thomas, and there was every reason in the world to attack this person. But we said he be black, and they added a thorn in our side without a murmur. Hypocrisy. Here's the man who condemned his sister for being on welfare rather than condemning the welfare system. If he sells out his sister, what do you think he will do for you? Here's a man that was there because of affirmative action, and then he turns around and condemns affirmative action. How bad a sellout can he get? But he should never have been to that position because he knew nothing. He was not an intellect. He was somebody whose only decisions, every position he had, was done by aides, done by lawyers, done by other people. And he just find on. And so they got a right-wing vote for everything they wanted because they had Clarence Thomas. He didn't even put smoke on it. And nobody has taken responsibility for that. The left has not taken responsibility. The black Christian leadership has not taken responsibility. The black misleadership class never mentioned the name Clarence Thomas. Their thing, as Great Brother Moore says, we have been zombieized. Here is the head zombie writing legislation, voting for legislation that will destroy us, and it will destroy him. But a zombie doesn't know about his own or our own destruction. And so I could go on, but I fear that I have the hook. The most important...
Yes, indeed, Brother Ralph. You don't have the hook for a frivolous reason. You have a packed house, and we want everybody to be aware of that. We've never had
okay,
so many
people.
Okay,
thank you for that. So I'm going to conclude with the number one problem in America is hypocrisy. America is thy name. And you can add that to every issue that we have to deal with. And so, therefore, back to Sister Betty at the controls.
Thank you, Brother Ralph. Thank you so much. Can you hear me, Ralph?
I hear you loud and clear. The elements
okay.
are such that we have a good signal tonight.
Yes, you have a good signal, but you're coming from some distance, and background noise can be heard. So I have most of the mics open. Please be aware.
There's nothing
okay.
but silence where I am. You know where I am in the country.
No, I'm not talking about
what?
The silence. I'm talking about any kind of movement can be fixed. Without further ado, we want to welcome back our Black Panther in residence, our former political prisoner who freed himself, our UN human rights petition expert, Brother Larry Pinckney. Welcome back, and give us your update. I know you've been aware of what's been going on with Sister Ramona. Sister Ann has been sending out emails. I hope they reached you. Without further ado, Brother Larry.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Sister Betty, Brother Ralph, to all and to all of the sisters and brothers who are on the show tonight. Look, I'm going to be extremely brief. I'm feeling a bit under the weather this evening, and I apologize for that. But I did want to call in because I had missed communicating with all of you, so I just made it a point. I had to call in. I just want to say before I get off that I send my love, my fraternal greetings, my love and my strength to Sister Ramona Africa, we are all pulling for you. We all love you. Let me just say, excuse me, one more thing, and that, or two more things, and that is to amend what Brother Ralph said. I would add Barack Obama to that list with Mr. Thomas, Clarence Thomas. I think that we need to take the blinders off. We really do. Third and final thing, I said, not feeling too good, but third and final thing I want to say, it's what I always say, let's keep our eyes on the prize of freeing our political prisoners. Please, please, we must free our political prisoners wherever they are. In so doing, we free ourselves. And with that, I'll say, as I always do, all power to the people. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brother Larry. And I would have been so disappointed if you had not put Barack's name in there. We were both counting on you to tighten it up and add the name of the blackface on imperialism, white imperialism. Thank you. Thank you for not disappointing me. Without further ado, we're going to go to our poet in residence, and I really want to commend him for the last two poems. I have gone back into my system online, and I have been reading them and rereading them. Once again, I really appreciate you, Raymond Matt Turner, and your mic is open.
Sister Betty.
Thank you so
Sister
much.
Sister Betty, you been here?
Of course.
Sister Betty. Okay, the program for October 7th at St. Mark's Theater to remember Lynn Stewart and to raise funds for Sister Ramona Africa is on. And so let's get busy sending out. I spoke with Raymond Nat Turner this afternoon, and he says, count me in. And so the New Abolitionist Movement, Lynn Stewart Organization, Raymond Nat Turner, and everyone else who wants to join in to support Ramona Africa economically, keep that date, October 7th, open St. Mark's Theater. Raymond Nat Turner, the mic is yours.
Okay. So will we have Sister Ann Lamb there on the 7th? That's a must. That's required.
Her mic is open. She can speak for herself.
Okay.
That depends what day of the week it is.
Okay. Anyway, this piece is called Deliver Us from Lesser Evil.
Okay.
Starstruck in childlike awe of celestial voices, silver tongues. I spent 7 hours glued to the screen back in the Baptist church celebrating, honoring the humanitarian North Star Shiro, genius in her field. What a day imbibing mighty black music, joyful noise. Lake Michigan-sized magnet gathering forces elbow to elbow. Enemies and the Orange Age allies on the clock. Basking in reflected light, assassins, informants, jailers, mouthpieces, mass murderers, super predators, slutty professors came riding bareback backwards on a donkey to the D, riding in corporate coats of many logos, then limboing their way center stage, tracking donkey dung down the red carpet, playing our emotions, our souls, our strength, our Achilles heel, like plastic kazoos, resurrecting the Democratic Party.
Thank you. I know Brother Ralph wants to comment on that one. Or anybody else, I'm opening up all the mics on that one.
that is so fantastic. But as I said to Raymond Nat Turner this afternoon, if he repeats all of the ones we want to be repeated, he'll never have a chance to do anything new. Whoa, right on.
All right,
so many
all
ways.
Mics.
But I'll shut up.
We're going to go to Sister Ann, and we have a special guest waiting in the wings. Don DeBar from CPR Metro is in the house. And going to some of his words of wisdom. Sister Ann, your mic is open.
Well, thank you so much. Well, as we have been talking about Ramona, I think everybody must continue to donate to Ramona. So if you go to jerichoandy.org, all the information is there. And if you click on Ramona's picture, you can read a wonderful history of the MOVE organization in case you don't know about it. We did see our dear friend, Dalil Muntakim, this past Sunday. He sends regards to everybody. He's cautiously optimistic. about the parole hearing on September 11th, of all days. So we'll see how it goes. I don't know how many people have had the opportunity or know that David Gilbert has a new book, which I would highly recommend, which is called Looking at the U.S. White Working Class Historically. Extremely, extremely interesting book. Not very long, not too long to read, has a lot of very good stuff in here, and it would be very interesting to read. Here's just a little paragraph that just happened to come at me when I opened the book. It says, when the Ohio 7, for example, began armed action, there were a small Boston area collective from mostly working class backgrounds forced underground for fighting U.S. backing of the apartheid regime in South Africa. It would be ironic if they become the last anti-apartheid fighters left in prison anywhere in the world. So it's really good, and I would highly recommend
yeah,
it.
Yeah, right on, Ann. Right on, David. Let us never forget the Ohio
yes.
7, David Gilbert, and all of those freedom fighters who have so much to contribute. We must bring
right.
them home so that they can free us all. Sorry.
Right. You're right, absolutely. So I'm hoping to go see David soon. You know, he's up in Buffalo, so he's not far away from certain other friends who are now up in Buffalo. So we can make a little, you know, couple of days out of it and visit Seth and see how he's doing in the outside world and go see David up at Wendy. And that would be really nice. And also visit Burning Books and Nate. So that will be something that we will hopefully be doing soon. Don't have a million things to report. I did speak with our friend Herman and our friend Seth, and both of them also send regards and are doing as well as can be expected, you know, getting used to being out here. So that's my brief report.
Our dear Ann Lamb, who makes us
yes.
emotionally connected to our political prisoners, because a people not emotionally connected to their warrior society will die. And Ann Lamb, I've sung too many praises. No, I don't have enough time to sing the praises of Ann for doing the work that we talk about. But I'll shut up for a moment.
So without further ado, we thank you for those comments, Sister Ann. And Brother Ralph. We have an echo.
Hello?
Yes, we do.
Yes, Don?
Yes.
The mic is open.
Yes. Yep, can you hear me?
We can hear you, but we're wondering about the echo.
Let me move the mic away from the speaker. And if that doesn't solve the problem, let me also pop in some earphones so I can listen through earphones and speak. How's that? Is that better?
Oh, you sound wonderful. Yes, that is better.
Okay, so there we go. Okay, so, hola. What's up? Hello?
Hello?
I'm here.
Hola, ¿cómo estás?
Yeah.
I'm throwing a little Spanish in there, too.
Yeah.
The theme is, what are the most important dangers, impending dangers of existence? Just to let everybody know.
Okay. Me? You're asking me? To answer the question, you got to look at where we are right now. The historic moment, almost epical moment, is a... sort of the close of the post-World War II order, both the economic order that, you know, the U.S. dollar and, you know, all of that that came to be the sort of the universal means, certainly since 91, and also with the U.S. as first... one of two superpowers, then the only superpower. You know, we're looking at a world now where there's rising this whole multipolar world, particularly on the Eurasian continent mass. And there are lots of dangers that are embedded in this transition or transformation, because the folks that think that they own the world right now don't want to let it up, give it up. They don't want to let go of it. It was only 2 weeks ago, I think, 3 weeks ago, there was a report made in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee by one of the undersecretaries at the State Department, basically laying out policy for the U.S. going forward. And first, they view Russia and China as rising global competitors. They intend to not allow that to happen, and they are going to oppose the opportunity of any hostile power to occupy the Eurasian landmass. In other words, Russia and China, as independent powers, are not going to be allowed to control their own real estate. This is now U.S. policy as of, I think it was the 21st of August, that the State Department. So the danger facing us, obviously, with that, with the context of the expansion of the military budget, the madness that's taking, passing for political discourse in the United States, where even Trump sitting down with Putin, I guess Trump labeled a traitor, and people calling for him to be not just impeached but prosecuted for being a traitor. With Russia being the enemy, public enemy number one, and this just madness, the danger we're facing is the danger of a global war, of World War III, of the literal World War III, not the one we've been engaged in, but of an actual, let's blow everything the hell up. That is the danger facing us, and there's really a shocking lack of work being done in opposition to this. The anti-war movement, for some reason, such as it is, for some reason can't find a vocabulary to engage the White House, for example, on questions of relations with Russia, détente with Russia and China, when the President of the United States says, I think it would be a good idea to have good relations with Russia, and the Congress turns around and 500-something to 6 or whatever says, you know what, no, hell with that, we're sanctioning them yet again. The anti-war movement has no skin in that game. It's like, well, Trump's a liar, he don't mean it anyway, and so there's really nothing we can do. But it's like they're just sitting here waiting until things get blown up. I don't know. They managed to march for a parade in Washington. That was important, I guess. But the actual dynamics that are shaping up in international relations between the U.S., Russia, and China, with the U.S. as a major aggressor, and it being what people are referring to as a deep state, but like a systemic, a drive towards this war, they don't seem to be able to address it at all. And if we don't have any tools to address it at all, it's going to run its course. And if it runs its course, we're going to be like radioactive vapor for a minute or whatever. That's where we're headed.
Well, thank you so much for that, Don. It is so true, but it is like when Muhammad Ali said, no Vietnamese calls me nigger. It was too powerful for people to repeat it. And so you get the history of Muhammad Ali saying, no Vietnamese calls me a name, because that was too powerful to be quoted. And now the thought of the United States being the aggressor against China and Russia is too powerful to be repeated. And so what do? We sit here like zombies. The anti-war movement, as you stated so clearly, we don't have a language to deal with that, for fear of appearing to side with Trump. No, we're not siding with Trump. We're opposing the American imperial agenda. And we have to develop a language that says we oppose the American imperial agenda, and make no mistake about it, Trump is a part of the American imperial agenda. He just likes a lot of personal imperialism to grease his own pocket.
There's also, you know, there are some things. Look, that class, okay, has some contradictions. And in a period of transition, you know, the transition itself is generated by, you know, the internal contradictions of the society, of the you know, of humanity, basically, and of our systems. Put it this way. There are some in, you know, within the elite that see the need for imperial retreat and a reconfiguration of the international systems in a way that, not because they want to stop exploiting us, but because they want to be able to continue to do it. Like they see us heading, some see themselves heading towards a cliff. And, you know, if we blow the world up, well, we can't make all these clowns work for us for free and steal all their stuff anymore. You know, I mean, that's what's driving it. It's not, you know, kind-heartedness. But you know, you have on the one hand policy that says, look, we're looking at a multipolar world, and we're going to try to engage at that level. The people, the elite that has the instrumentalities of the state, the United States and Europe, you know, whatever, the EU, NATO, Japan, South Korea, they know that they come to the table under those conditions pretty well armed, literally and figuratively. And so, and of course, they know that they can replay, or they're trying to replay, they may have played that card out, what they did in the 50s and 60s. You run a three-card game, and you split off one from the other, and you know that they can make this thing last for a good long time. And in addition to that, I mean, if you just think in terms of, you know, standard, like Marxist thinking, at the base, the economic needs of humanity right now, 6, 7, 7.5 billion people, whatever it is, like half of them don't have housing. Septic water systems, electric grid, proper roads, infrastructure, you know, all of the things that the half of the world does have, half don't. And the wherewithal to construct those things exists. China, with its economic model, some of the other, countries and configurations, SEO and others, there are ways for these people to make money. On the one hand, on the other hand, to develop the other half of the world, they could blow air into their own system for another, 50 to 150 years by just finishing the development of the earth and providing some of the needs of humanity. And so then you reach the point where capitalism has completely expended itself. I mean, if you look around the world, it's hard not to come to the conclusion that day didn't pass a long time ago. Because the reason a lot of people are...
I want to pass the mic to Brother Joel so he can complete that analysis, because Joel does this for us every week, and then after that we're going to go to Tom, and we've got Gwen and Richie. But one of the things I do want to say is the only thing that's going to stop it is people who push back and resist. And every time there is resistance, there are political prisoners. And so once again, we're back where we started. When you have the courage to protect and defend political prisoners, you protect your army. You got to protect your army. All right, go ahead, Brother Joel. Your mic is open, and Brother Tom is be waiting in the wings.
May I interject here for a moment, Ralph here?
We've got a lot of people lined up.
I will make it brief. We're going to have a program on international economics and where those other guys, I'm talking about China, Russia, Brazil, India, where are they going economically, which will affect all of us. We'll have a program on that. I'm out.
Okay, Brother Joel, your mic is open. Can you hear us? Joel?
Joel, are you there? Take it off mute, Joel.
Okay, we're going to go to Tom, and then we'll come back to Joel. Tom, your mic is open.
Thank you, everyone. You know, it is just amazing how making McCain into a hero, and all of these eulogies at
right.
the National Cathedral. By the way, that funeral was carefully orchestrated and planned by McCain himself. You can imagine what kind of an ego a person would have to plan the details of a funeral like that. And there you had the Republican and the Democratic establishment all seated there honoring this man who was a warmonger, an imperialist, and of course, you know, all the people that are sitting there, both the Democratic and the Republican Party, they also are warmongers and imperialists. Now, the
yeah.
question was brought up, whatever happened to the anti-war movement in this country? Well, what
yeah.
happened to it was that it was dominated by a warmongering party, namely the Democrats.
Yeah.
And so once a Democrat was elected president, that was the end of the anti-war movement. Another point that was brought up about that we don't seem to have the language of to deal with all of these issues. Well, that's the reason we don't have the language is because we have a mass media that prevents us from using any kind of a language that makes sense to the public. You know, there was a phony debate between Cuomo and Cynthia Nixon Wednesday. Cuomo didn't want to debate at all, and he only consented if he had complete control over the debate, and that only one channel, CBS, would be allowed to broadcast that debate. And so I and some others, we organized the demonstration in front of CBS, and I personally sent out at least 40 emails to various press contacts. And guess how many of the press showed up to this demo in front of CBS? Zero. Not that I was surprised about that, but this was just another example of the phony democracy that we have in this country. Of course, that is one of the problems that we have, is that the American public has to be they have to know their history. They have to educate themselves, and that how this is to be done is a huge, huge problem. And hopefully, groups like this blog can help in doing that. And here we have a situation where there's a national strike among people in prison. And what kind of publicity are we getting about that? Nothing. And yet, this is a marvelous, wonderful thing that prisoners are on strike, and hopefully this strike will grow. You won't see any strikes in this country, any general strikes led by the unions, because here again, the unions are controlled by the capitalist party, namely the Democratic Party. And so that is something that unfortunately the public still has to realize, that the Democratic Party is just one side of the same coin as the Republican Party. They are controlled by big money, and they certainly have no interest in furthering the working class in this country. And of course, here we have, yesterday was so-called Labor Day. I don't celebrate this as Labor Day. The original Labor Day was formed by the Second International of Socialist and Communist Parties in 1891 to commemorate the so-called Haymarket massacre in Chicago in 1886. The IWW, the International Workers of the World, that was a union that was growing, that started here in the United States, and it was growing throughout the world. The last thing that ruling capitalists want is an international union of workers. Workers throughout the world that are aware of their common interest, and that they be, and that and their the power of their solidarity. That is the last thing that is wanted, that can be tolerated, and therefore the majority of countries in the world still celebrate May 1st as Labor Day. But the United States and a couple of other countries wanted to break up this international solidarity. And now we have this phony Labor Day yesterday. And what is the condition of organized American labor here in this country? It's much worse than it ever was. Certainly, it's much worse than it was in during the days of the internet, the IWW. In 1950, over 30% of the salaried workers in the United States were organized into unions. You know what the percentage is today? 9%. And so we have no real organized labor in this country that is for the working man, and that's what is another thing that is needed. And our hats off to the prisoners throughout the United States that are organizing a general strike, something impossible to be organized by the present labor unions. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Tom.
We got to interrupt
something.
Here. Yes.
Yes. Thank you so much for that, Tom. But understand.
Yes, hello?
America has never had a general strike. And as close as they came to talking about a general strike were the immigrants. And now we have the prisoners. When will the American worker wake up to their needs and understand the necessity of cooperating with others?
Thank you, Brother Ralph. We're racing against time. Oh, I'm going to have to be rude and interject here. Joel's mic is open and he's ready to go.
Okay, can you hear me this time?
Much better.
Yes, we can.
Yes.
Yes, okay. For some reason, I didn't seem to get audible, and who knows why that is. But anyway, I wanted to say that we we have to face what we're really up against with imperialism. You know, back in the day when imperialism first became a central topic within the Marxist working class movement, and that was after the Russian Revolution, and it was signified by Lenin's pamphlet, Imperialism, the Highest State of Capitalism. And in that pamphlet, one of the arguments made is that imperialism is the social basis of the material basis of opportunism within the working class movement. And that word opportunism, you know, we hear it all the time. It's taking advantage of opportunities is what it means to most people. But what it means in the more technical sense and in the way it was used at that time, it meant abandoning the struggle against the capitalist system and going in for a policy of class collaboration in which the working class would be given certain, we could say, crumbs that dropped from the table in order to socially bribe the working classes around the world into siding with their own imperialists against other imperialists and also against the efforts by working people where they have a strong movement for working class based revolution. And the working people in a lot of countries, not least of which is the United States, very often at least imagine that they benefit from imperialism and identify with imperialism on a material basis, because by super exploiting large portions of the world, robbing their resources, and that can accumulate a lot of wealth and create a stratified world working class, so that a lot of people, let's say in the United States, they want the United States to control the resources, and they imagine that they benefit from it. Now, it's not just what happens with other countries, because what happens with other countries is an outgrowth of what happened, especially in the United States itself. That is, centuries of racial slavery before the final phase of capitalism, imperialism, had developed. At home, there was racial slavery and genocidal conversion of the land that was the life-sustaining force of the native peoples into capitalist wealth. And some of that wealth was distributed to people, you know, like they're glorified as the cowboys and the pioneers and everything else, but they were given land grants, and these land grants were all grants that were given from land that was stolen from the native people. And Marx had actually written at the time that machinery was only part of the basis of the creation of the world capitalist system, or at least it spread to Europe. The other basis was slavery in the United States and the growth of the King cotton industry, which created the basis for the consolidation of capitalist wealth, not only in the United States, throughout the world, and that he felt that this was as much a force in the development of capitalism as was industrialized machinery in itself, that the super exploitation and the racial slavery and the genocidal land theft in the United States created this enormous wealth. And then it began to spread around the world, where the United States became a partner with the French and the British empires, and by the end of World War II had largely taken over those empires ideologically, converting the relationships between the former direct colonies to what are called neo-colonies. That is, the country would be countries that used to be direct colonies would be nominally independent countries, but with their industries and land owned by the corporations of the great powers. And since World War II, the chieftain of all of that was the United States. So in order to know what we're dealing with, we have to face it that it's not just although this adds a lot to it, you fan the flames of it, it's not just from on high that people get corrupted by lies and everything else, but there's a tendency towards corruption among a population in the United States that came here to party on the basis of the wealth created by racial slavery, not primarily Europeans, and genocidal land theft, which meant that there was a bright big light in the United States other than the one that's usually touted, which is supposed political freedom, which is a joke. But it's a very sad joke because the corruption extends from the top to the bottom, and that's what we have to hammer away at in order to enable people to understand and to, yes, to feel guilty about and to want to have a more just world if we're going to have democratic standards, meaning that there has to be equality and equally shared power among all the nations of the world, not just as a slogan among those that are robbing everybody else blind. So I want
all
to
right.
call people's attention
Thank you.
To that.
Thank you, Joel. I've got to interject here because we've got a few more people waiting in the wings, and you're giving us a whole lot to digest. Like Tom, you put in a lot of history. So can you give us your final sentence so that we can go on to Sister Collier?
I don't know.
We lost him again.
Okay, Collier, your mic is open, dear.
Yeah, good evening to everybody. Hello, Betty. Hello, Raph, as always. Thank you for this avenue, this airway, so we can get out messages to the world. And would like to say to all who have presented, I have truly, truly learned a lot. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And to Sister Ramona, Africa, and her struggle, this great warrior sister of ours, let us keep her always in the front of our minds and in the front of this discussion so that the world will know that we not only love her, but we must raise money for her. I was asked by Sister Betty to take a look at the Africans coming out of slavery down to, in fact, this day. And I thought that maybe it would be best that I look at the schemes and designs of Northern capital to tighten and fasten the newly freed African into a system of permanent servitude and the ways in which blacks resisted. We usually don't see black resistance, but we will see it this evening. Struggle in the USA is not easy. Telling the story of this hour, 1865 to 1905, when the freedom for the African is being defined. It's the history of how freedom is defined for Africans coming out of bondage after more than 246 years of British and 305 years of Spanish slavery. To fully understand the dimensions of this period, we need an overview of a period which exposes the goals of the key players on all sides of this issue. What were the plans of the industrialist Lincoln and the Republicans and their supporters? What were the plans of the Confederates and who are their supporters? What are the plans of the African liberationists and their supporters? We do not want to create yet another narrow framework for this urgent period in the emergence of U.S. capitalism, which means a deeper look at the push toward industrialization and the forces which create, organize, and finance it is imperative if we're going to understand why there was a civil war, and beyond that, the narrow answer that historian, beyond what the narrow answer that historians provide. In this war to end slavery, is it a war to expand industrialization beyond the South into the South with an industrial model, much as we see this same pattern with the civil rights movement of the 60s. In the case of the civil rights struggle on the economic front, it's opening up the South to industry away from its entrenchment in agricultural economy. A mixed model of agriculture, big businesses, and factories are the result. It's also industry is prime example, but with it comes a push for organized labor. Someone was speaking of labor earlier. You'll see that as we begin to look at that period 1865 to 1965. The purpose of this discussion, we will focus on slavery as a major cause for the Civil War, or at least the most publicized outcome. The Civil War unfolds with Lincoln and the South at odds over slavery. The North of the U.S. government wins against the breakaway South under the banner of the Confederacy. For four brutal, bloody years that leave enduring scars on the nation, a war is fought to secure the Union. It ends with the freedom of Africans from slavery. At least that is what the nation and world are told. Northern industrial capitalists clearly have one interest, and it is industrialization. The development of a modern industrial nation capable of competing in international markets. All the pieces are in place, with the inclusion of a wayward South following the bloody Civil War. The two agree to move in the direction of a U.S. industrialization. The South is clearly given a concession of maintaining control over the U.S. Navy, the Marines, as was the case in the creation of the nation in 1787 and 89. The unmentioned concession, represented in three compromises in the U.S. Constitution 1789, is the newly freed Africans what is to be their fate. A major drama begins with key elements in place to define the place for the African in the United States. In order to secure their objectives, white northern power brokers, in cahoots with the southern aristocracy, begun an aggressive war on the newly freed Africans. All those forces that had helped to end slavery as a private legal institution had to become enemy of the newly freed African or risk becoming permanently marginalized. These forces that participated in the anti-slavery resistance movement were white church and religious institutions and leaders, white organized labor, the white middle and upper middle class women, and indigenous nations and peoples. To accomplish their demonic goals, northern capitalists would work closely with the southern aristocracy to strike a deadly blow using old black codes and Bentonville codes as legal mechanisms and terrorist instruments that define the newly freed African as bottom tier of society, having no real rights that anyone need respect. In short, the newly freed African, though classified as free in the law, 13th Amendment, is placed in a state of permanent servitude which honors and gives respect to the Supreme Court decision of 1859, which defines Africans' place in the USA as having no rights which anyone need respect. Defining the freedom is the first design to maintain free Africans in subservient roles. Friends of Africans in the Senate make moves to block what they recognize was clear obstruction to Africans' movement from technically new owners, which was the United States government, now that they left plantation ownership, to a place of free and independent citizens. The Supreme Court, yes.
I'm going to have to interject, and I hope you can come back next week and finish this, but we've got
I'd be willing to do that because what I'm going to do is try to put this online. I've been trying to type it up and get it clean so people can read it. So I would like to do that.
If you can't come back this week, I hope you can come back week after next. And we're going to have to extend the program because if you notice, all of our speakers today have shown the connections between the main topic. You have all given us a piece of what oppression is. I want to open the mic for Rick. Richie, your mic is open.
Yes, this is Richie Anarchist, the speaker for Michael Kimball. The anarchist political prison in Alabama was recently attacked. His ribs are broken. He was jumped by goon squad in the prison that he is in. And the guys are looking for cell phones and knives. They know Michael doesn't have any of that. They're notorious for being brutal, sadistic, stormtroopers. It cracked, sustained cracked ribs, and other bruises. Did they attack Michael because he was one of the leading voices in the prisoner strike you've been talking about all night? He sent me a flyer for the national prisoner strike that he made himself. He's been promoting, working, and organizing for this, and he thinks things are promising. They know who he is. I call him the anarchist Mamiya. If you read his information on online, Michael Kimball, you'll see what I'm talking about. And he talks about how he's alone in his prison in Alabama. And he says, I'm alone in this MF. And I have someone to talk to because I write to him. And these guys in here don't really help him at all. There are two prisoner strikes. There are the ones controlled by the liberals that are politically correct, that are controlled. And there's people like Michael Kimball. That's why they attacked him. Then they gave him a disease. They put him in a cell with no shoes, no bed, no pillow, and gave him he had to go to a nurse after he got this disease, and he's been in there for I don't know how long. I just got his letter, and he needs help. There's lawyers in Ohio that want to help him, but they want money to help him. He has a couple of people helping him, but I can't help him by myself. He needs a lot of help. He's been in there 20 years, defending himself against a neo-Nazi who said he was in a Klan and tried to kill him. And Michael did self-defense and killed him instead. And so that's the situation for Michael Kimball. And anybody who wants to call me or get in touch, like Michael or anybody else with Val Pointer and the show, and I will try and get in touch with you to help Michael Kimball.
Keep us apart.